This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning. You're listening to The Morning Run on BFM 89.9, the business station. We've got the breakfast grill coming up in just about 15 to 20 minutes, just after the 8 o'clock news. And I don't know about you, but I'm still in a Raya mood. Still, so we thought we'd put together a Raya panel today on the grill.
Absolutely. We have, as we did during Chinese New Year, we had a Chinese New Year panel talking about issues related to the Chinese community, and today it'll be the Malay Muslim community, because it is celebrated, by people of different ethnic backgrounds, but who share a common faith.
We will be having Ahmad Fuad Rahmat, lecturer in cultural studies at Nottingham University, Malaysia.
Also of night school fame.
Yes.
Together with Sharad Kapoor.
Who
is that masked man?
Okay. Also, Daniel Abdurrahman, press secretary to the Minister of Higher Education. Both of them will be discussing some concerns and challenges in advancing inter and intra community dialogue within the Malay Muslim community here in Malaysia. Also, a quick look at our Twitter feed. Roberto Caleja, he said that Pokemon is an 80s, 90s game. People with the purchasing power are the ones having it and playing it. And that's a really good point, because, you know, it's the 30-somethings now who are buying these apps.
I shudder to think about a situation where 50-year-olds are going around the streets of KL looking for little Pikachus.
Oh, picking Pokemon. You know, it used to be there were so many fads when we were growing up, but you couldn't really monetize them beyond the first purchase, like hula hoops and yo-yos. I mean, you just play the yo-yo.
There are no in-app purchases.
No, you buy the yo-yo. That's how you monetize it. You pay for the yo-yo.
But it's a one-off, right? Here you have an endless possibility of making money even beyond the first purchase.
Dr. Fu says, stop asking our children to be doctors and lawyers. Ask them to be game creators instead.
I think that's a bit of sarcasm from Tima Quinta.
Okay, taking a look at the local business scene, there's news that the RSC, or the Risk Service Contract, Malaysia's first risk RSC ever to be awarded by Petronas for the development of the Berantai Marginal Oil Field, has finally come to an end. And the reason is because at the point where they signed the contract, oil prices were $100 per barrel. Now it's less than half.
Yeah, this is about, actually it's risk sharing, if I'm not mistaken, risk
Sharing a contract,
mm-hmm. right? Because it's about sharing of the risk. And what do you do when oil prices are about $100 per barrel and you can't get enough oil? So you try to suck them out of various things like stones and tar sands underneath the seabed and things like that, right? So this was at a time in those days when $100 oil made such things really profitable. Now that the oil price have crashed, you know, to we talked about sub $20 oil at the start of this year. Now, to the relief of many people, has gone back up to $40-$50. But still, it made a lot of these ventures quite unprofitable. So we're seeing the last of them, those that was in charge of by Sapura Kencana and Dialogue Group, they've seizing these contracts now.
Yeah, I guess now that, so you're right. So Dialogue ceased operations in its Balai Marginal Oil Field back in February. And now that Sapura Kencana, Petronas and Petrofac are calling this Berantai RSC off as well. So these two now are putting, I guess, because they've closed down, it really puts the pressure or puts the spotlight on the other RSC structures. People, I guess, still, four companies still in a play, people like Uzma and Skomi Engineering, Petra Energy, all with their own RSCs, right?
Mm-hmm. I think, you know, speaking of sucking oil out of, you know, any conceivable thing, I think, you know, oil fields should be constructed around or behind the backs of many restaurants. I think many of them indulge in throwing oil out into our drains to the detriment of our water system.
That is also a legitimate business. Actually, people have thought about doing that, Sharad. So you're kind of late to the game as well.
But sorry.
At least you thought of that idea.
Great minds think alike. Yeah. Some great minds think very slowly.
But anyhow, this sharing of risk between Petronas and other players is not new. Petronas does have what I call production sharing contracts, because Petronas doesn't want to be involved with the riskiness of the entire cost of exploration of an oil field. But those are with conventional oil fields, and those kind of sharing I guess, is a little bit more intense for the sharer, because they, if the oil field doesn't yield anything, they actually bear the cost of that exploration.
So
do you think
that, okay, so this is the first RSC that Petronas awarded. Was this a good signal that Petronas says, okay, we're going to cut our losses and get out of this game? Or does it signal something worse for the rest who are still in the game? You know, I can't make up my mind whether to say, okay, great, Petronas is saying we don't want to lose any more money on this venture, or the fact that this is just, you know, it's going to go downhill from here.
I think it's not that big because the conventional oil fields that you find off the coast of, you know, Sabah, Sarawak, off the coast of Terengganu and Indonesia and all those kinds of oil fields, those are the biggies, right? These RSCs are just for marginal oil fields with little... I guess when they started out, they didn't even know whether they could actually make this profitable.
Right.
So not much had been invested into it. I guess it's an end of an era of expensive oil.
Well, also, you're right. It's timing, right? Because the break-even price for the marginal oil fields to be economically viable was around $60 per barrel. So given the prices that it's at now, it's just not economically viable. But also, in related news, Transparency International has lauded Petronas for taking the 9th spot among 100 large state-owned enterprises in emerging markets for its reporting practices.
Yes, they're also asking Petronas to be neutral, because Petronas is supposed to safeguard the resources of the country and not fund political parties unnecessarily. That's the advice of TI Malaysia President Datuk Akbar Sattar.
So Petronas allows for political contributions with certain disclosures, yet it remains ambiguous and opaque without specifically naming the politicians or parties involved. So perhaps a little bit more transparency in this respect. 8:54 right now, Air Asia is what we're looking at. Air Asia is studying a dual listing in Hong Kong. Could this be the case of wanting to tap into the Chinese market?
I don't know. Again, you know, we saw Top Glove listing, having that dual listing in Singapore, and I was just questioning the purpose of that. Hong Kong is also within the same time zone as KL. And again, investors are very smart. So really, is there a reason for AirAsia to list Hong Kong? Will it continue to drive up the share price, as AirAsia has and AirAsia Rex have both done well recently in stock market returns?
What about visibility? I mean, if you are on an important stock, an equity market listing board, as opposed to something that's sort of secondary, do you think you have more chance of drawing money? Is that the possibility?
Personally, I don't think so. I mean, I don't have the actual research to support what I think, but you know, people are playing Pokemon, developed by Nintendo in Japan, and this is being played by everybody from US, New Zealand to, I hear, Malaysia too. I don't know whether this is available in Malaysia right now, but probably the jailbroken version. But you know, if you as a clever, smart investor, you will be able to suss out and sniff out opportunities all around the world, including with frontier markets like Vietnam, Iran, and so on. Right. Is there a need to list a company to have dual listing for markets within the same time zone?
Yeah, so I guess time zone is a big difference, right? So you list in the UK or the US, so you cater for the European and the North American market. But in Hong Kong, to me, time zone aside, I think this speaks of a pivot to North Asia, a pivot to Hong Kong and China and Macau, and trying to tap into that market, which I believe AirAsia in the past have said that they're quite interested in.
Yeah. What about are all investors, especially the smaller ones, as savvy? You know, are they surveying all the possibilities out there, or are they often driven by, you know, sort of a much more kind of narrow focus on their domestic markets and, you know, stock exchanges?
Well, stock markets around the world have been going through a very strong trend of institutionalization, which means that these are money managed by professional. I mean, we are talking about very, very high percentages of institutionalization. In the US, I think that figure goes up to about 80 to 90%. So the idea of small investors sussing out their little investment is something in the minority. Your money now is being managed by a professional manager. But the other thing that I think supports a dual listing in jurisdictions like Singapore or Hong Kong is that perhaps you want to expose yourself to a different, I don't want to say better or higher governance standards, right?
Different.
But a different kind of governance standard that you may find in Hong Kong or Singapore, and that might give you that experience in governance and reporting.
Well, speaking about Hong Kong, Genting Hong Kong will invest 100 million euros in its German shipyard, MB Werften. I hope I'm saying that right. There's three shipyards in one of the German states that they bought in April this year, and that will be managed in Wismar and will focus on building new large ships. So they're going to invest 100 million euros in this.
Getting Hong Kong, it's involved in cruises around the world. So it's interesting that they are buying into shipbuilders, because this is usually a very risky industry. I mean, building ships. And we know that in the past few years, the shipping industry has not been really doing well because of what's happening in China. But because Genting focuses on cruise lines, right, and they have a lot of cash sloshing around, right? So it might make sense for them to buy into a shipping firm in Germany, no less.
Okay, so there are two parts of the maritime business, right? So you've got the logistics and the shipping side. And then you've
oil
got the,
and so on.
And then you've got the cruise liners and the tourism side. And the tourism side is really kicking off. I think I spoke to Princess Cruises on the Breakfast Grill not too long ago. And, you know, they're saying, look, the business is really coming from this corner of the world. What used to be a kind of fuddy-duddy old Western holiday, you know, with the love boat in the 70s.
The love boat.
There you go.
You know the song.
I do know it, yeah. But now, in this day and age, is actually a younger kind of younger generation holiday. So
partying on the boat,
kind of taking a cruise, is a shorter cruise, not a cruise around the world to Alaska, for instance. But this is where the growth pocket is for cruises.
Also, I think Genting is the other part of the business is gaming. And when you're cruising along international waters, you don't have to be subjected to local laws, I guess. It's very synergistic to business. I'm not sure about diversifying into building, because to me, it is a diversification, even if you are making ships for your own business, right? Mm-hmm. And yesterday in Pressing Matters, we also talked about how Genting is going to the Alzheimer's drug, right?
So 14 years they've invested in research and development in trying to get a cure for Alzheimer's. Can you imagine
so
that?
It's really a case of having too much money, perhaps.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.